To go to the toilet? She finds a seat behind the driver. There's a sticker on the dashboard that says,
Would you like to speak to the man in charge or the woman who knows what's happening?
She watches the white dashes on the road. She loves how, if the bus moves fast enough, they join together in one long white line that splits the world in half.
Have you ever seen chicken come in a bucket?
Millie says to the bus driver. The bus driver doesn't answer for ages. She just sits there and drives as if Millie hasn't spoken at all. Millie's about to say it again when the bus driver says,
Oh, I done this for 30 years.
She gazes out over the road, and it's hard to tell if she's talking to herself or to Millie.
You reckon you wouldn't learn much, driving up and down the same patch over and over?
They pass a bright green paddock with one grey leafless tree sticking out of the middle of it. It looks like a person trying to attract attention. Millie waves at it. On either side of the road, the ground is flat and wide, and completely white. The sun shines directly on it, and Millie has to shield her eyes from the glare.
Is that snow?
She asks. The bus driver snorts.
You never seen the salt flats?
Nope,
Millie replies, wanting to lick the paddock of salt more than anything. Her forehead bumps softly on the window.
There was water there once, the bus driver continues. Then the salt came up and...
She makes slurping noises.
Sucked it all up, killed off everything around it.
Oh.
There are swirls and shapes all over it, like giants have been finger-painting.
But then all sorts of things turn up that couldn't grow there before. Pretty beaut, eh?
The salt glitters at Millie in the sunlight.
It's tough out there, though,
the bus driver goes on.
All them hippies down our way going to find themselves in India or whatever. Hanging upside down, eating lentils. It's nothing. Walk in the park. Spend a night out here and you'll find yourself pretty quick.
Millie can see herself in the reflection on the window. It seems strange to want to find yourself. Wouldn't you want to find somebody else? Aren't you the one thing you can be sure of? She puts her real hand on the glass, up against her reflection hand. They drive past rows of gum trees, leaning out over the road and into the sky, like dancers posing.
Those trees there, the bus driver says. See how pink they are?
Millie nods. They make her think of the inside of her mouth.
Salmon gums. Always looks like the sun's setting on them.
Millie stares at them.
That your granny back there?
Millie shrugs.
What's that on your wrist?
The bus driver says. Millie looks down at the beer cozy.
It was my dad's. He died.
The bus driver looks at Millie in the rearview mirror.
What are you going to die for?
Dunno.
She nods.
Righto.
The bus starts to slow.
I'm Millie Bird.
Stella, love. The name's Stella.
The bus driver yanks her collar.
These are my brother's clothes. His bus too. He went and died too.
Millie nods.
What about your mum? Stella says. Listen here, toilet brush!
Agatha interrupts. She has made her way up the aisle and steadies herself by holding on to the back of Stella's seat.
Does the train still leave from Kalgoorlie?
Stella squints at her in the mirror.
Nah, she says. No? They got the flying cars now. That'll take you straight there. Fast, too.
Okay, Agatha says.
Okay, toilet brush. If you don't want to help, just say so. Hey, lady, I'm not the bloody info center. I can drop you at the station. Work it out yourself. Can't you just yell out the window to one of your relatives? Hey, Mary! When's the train go?
Stella flicks on the indicator and pulls the bus off the road. Gravel skidding beneath the wheels. She brings the bus to a halt at a bus shelter. Lake Cartwheel, she announces. The door opens and a tall boy with earphones in his ears walks down the aisle of the bus and down the steps. Stella turns her body so it faces the door, one arm resting on the top of her seat, the other draped over the steering wheel.
"Not my problem," Stella says to Agatha.
But she doesn't look at her, and instead watches the passengers file onto the bus. A little boy with glasses and slicked down hair takes big lunges up the stairs.
"G'day, young Lawrence," Stella says.
"Hello, Stella,"
Lawrence says without looking up. Stella knows all the new passengers by name. Mrs. Cranley, Timbo, Vince, Felicity, and they all know her name back. The last man on is big and wide and wears a bright fluorescent vest. He has dirt on his face and arms and hands.
"G'day, Stell," he says.
"Trent,"
she says, flicking her head upward in recognition. He pauses at the top of the stairs and points a thumb in the direction that he came.
"There's some bloke on his way," he says. "Gonna be waiting a while. He's about 175,
he grins. "Give or take." And then there's a surprise like balloons bursting, because Carl appears at the bottom of the steps. He has the mannequin tucked under his arm and is breathing heavily. Sweat drips down his face. Millie feels her heart in her chest as she jumps down the steps and wraps her arms around Carl's neck.
"Just Millie," he says.
And then Agatha says,
"Did you follow me, Gene Wilder?"
She reaches in her handbag, pulls out an Anzac biscuit, and throws it at him.
Agatha Panther. Agatha and Carl actually know each other, sort of. Carl used to walk past her house, always wearing that purple suit. Sometimes he wore a long jacket, too, one that reached his toes.
"Not enough hair," she might yell from her chair of discernment. "Ridiculous suit! Annoying face! Trying to look like Gene Wilder!"
He stood there once, for more than a few moments, and caressed her fence. She had initially been so flabbergasted that real words wouldn't form outside her head.
"Gah!" she yelled. "Sah!" she tried. "What?" she said eventually.
She stood up, blood rushing to her head, and stuck her index finger out the window as far as it would go.
"Stop molesting my fence!"
She pushed her head through the window and pointed her finger at him. The man jumped and looked toward her.
"Shoo!" she yelled. "Yes, you! You're touching!"
He grabbed the top of her fence with both hands.
"I'm sorry,"
he shouted back, his hands tapping on her fence.
"I didn't mean to. It's just that I can help you with those weeds."
Agatha pointed her finger down the street.
"Walk!" she yelled. "Know how to do that?"
He did walk, but ran his finger along her fence as he did so. He was back the very next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. He would lean over her fence and rip out her weeds. She would lean through the window and try to hit him with day-old Anzacs. He bothered her. He bothered her very much.
"You bother me," she'd occasionally yell as he walked off down the street.
She'd press her face against the window, her breath fogging up the glass. He never looked back, and this bothered Agatha even more. She didn't know why.
"Why does he bother me so much?"
she yelled as she watched him scamper down the street, peeking into front yards. And then, one day, he stopped coming suddenly, and she stood at the window from 12:51 p.m. to 1:32 p.m. for a week, dipping her fingers into a bowl of rock-hard Anzacs, waiting. And he didn't turn up, and it felt like vertigo.
Carl, the touch typist. He had hugged Millie and it felt like something he didn't deserve but wished he did. Surely he had once held his son like that. But the feeling seemed brand new. And now the other woman is here, making his life more interesting, more complicated. Another thing Carl knows about, Agatha. He knew the woman's story, the whole town of Warwickvale did. Scott and Amy had driven past her house one day after they'd taken Carl grocery shopping. Amy turned to his son and said, "I hope you don't expect me to barricade myself in our house if you cark it." "Too right I do," Ames, his son, said, "but if you go first, I'm throwing a party." Amy poked his son playfully in the ribs. "Slow down," she said, "let's have a peek." "Nah," his son said, "let's leave her alone." "Come on," Amy said, "sometimes you can see her looking out the window." Carl had never thought this woman's story to be relevant and had quarantined it to the realm of things Amy found interesting. The misfortunes of others, pigs small enough to be put in handbags, a man called Dr. Phil. But now that he was looking at this woman's house, he saw the story was very relevant. It was like looking at the inside of his guts in the form of a house. Dark and dying, it had waved its white flag long ago.
"Oh, there she is," Amy said.
The woman looked straight at them out of her window, her face cold and hard.
"Creepy," Amy said, as they drove off. She added, "Shutting yourself in like that, is that romantic, depressing, or just plain lunacy?"
"All three, I reckon," his son said. "What do you think, Dad? She's a single lady. Wouldn't me to leave you on her doorstep?" Carl didn't say anything. Everything about that house and that woman's face had made him feel less alone. They stand outside the train station in Kalgoorlie, next to a war memorial, the statue of a soldier with a gun at the ready looking out above their heads. Four-wheel drives whiz past them, huge sprays of rusty red dotted and caked on their cars like art. The roofs of the pubs sweep across the sky in regal commanding lines. On the bus, on the way in, Carl had read the chalkboard outside one of the pubs. "Hot topless skimpies," it read, which sounded to Carl like something you might catch in a saltwater lake. He stared at the sign for a few minutes as the bus idled at the traffic lights. The slow realization of what it actually meant spread over his cheeks in hot red patches. Back home, on the southwest coast, the people have dazed eyes, blonde edges, waterlogged strides. The people here are different. Scratchy, like they've been sketched roughly on paper, like they are born of the very red dirt they scuff their feet in, made out of the salmon gums that line the streets. They yell outside the bakery, the supermarket, the pubs, and in the main thoroughfare, chopping at words as though throwing their sentences into a blender. Carl doesn't feel like he fits in here. Then again, Carl doesn't feel like he fits in back there, either. The sky is between day and night, that deep blue it gets when it's shedding one for the other. Agatha storms toward Carl and Millie. She's difficult to make out in the deepening dark, but there's something about the way she walks that means he will never mistake her for anyone else. As though she is fighting with the air, as though the air is as thick as a sheet and she has to tear her way through it. "Well, it doesn't leave until tomorrow," she says, a cloud of dust surrounding her like a force field. "I bet that Stiller woman knew it too." "Never trust a woman skinnier than you. Write that down." "What are we going to do, typist?" "I'm not going to sit around here all night gawking at you lot. It's 7:37 at night. We don't have any money." Carl feels a rising sense of panic when he realizes he's the only man there. Men have certain obligations in these circumstances, he knows. He can feel the eyes of all women on him. Not just the ones with him now, but generations of women, spanning centuries, countries, cultures. "Well," he says in what he hopes is a commanding voice, "we have to do something." He points at the air with his index finger to punctuate the sentence. He begins to pace, hoping that the movement might jiggle the decision-making part of his brain.
"Let's hide," Millie suggests.
Carl considers this.
"That sounds pretty good."
"A friend of mine came to Kalgoorlie once," Agatha says. "Never came back. Don't know what happened to her. No one said for sure. But I know. She's in one of those brothels right now, doing her business. She takes a deep breath, but then snaps her mouth shut. It appears something has caught her eye. She holds on to the fence of the war memorial and glares at it. "They shall grow not old," she reads, "as we that are left grow old." Agatha seems unable to move. "As we that are left," she repeats. She puts a hand gingerly on the base of her throat. Millie puts her arms through the gap between the bars in the fence and looks up at Agatha.
"What's a brothel?"
Agatha turns her back on the war memorial, just as she says, "What are you two looking at?" A bus pulls off the road into the parking lot and stops next to them. The bus door opens. It's Stella.
7 o'clock,
Stella says.
"Excuse me?"
Agatha says, peering into the bus, her stance thick and wide, planting her feet on the ground as if in a standoff.
"The train, Grumblebum, leaves at 7 in the morning."
"Thought we weren't your problem," Agatha says.
"I changed my mind, haven't I?"
Stella says.
Millie Bird. Stella's house makes a lot of sounds. The floor talks when Millie walks on it, and it's like there are people wandering about in the ceiling and the walls, maybe trying to get in and out or maybe tap dancing. Millie isn't to know. The whole house looks like the thrift store back home. So many things that don't match all piled together and forced to get along. Millie keeps finding new things she hasn't seen before, and she wonders if this is why Stella does it, to keep forgetting and discovering. Millie has a bath and makes entire cities out of bubbles, houses and skyscrapers and driveways and trees and a cemetery and a supermarket and a school and a police station and a post office. She's in there for so long that the water goes cold. And Stella lifts her out of the bath, wraps her in a towel, and plonks her in front of a heater with red glowing bars across it. And later, Millie sits at the kitchen table with Carl and Agatha, while Stella makes spaghetti for all of them. Manny is allowed in the kitchen too, but there aren't enough chairs for him, so Carl props him up against the wall, close to the microwave. Millie smiles at Manny while she's slurping up spaghetti. When they've all finished their dinner, Stella makes cups of tea for everyone except Millie, who gets a big bowl of ice cream. Agatha and Carl sit in the lounge room. "We're ringing your mum in the morning," Agatha says on her way out of the kitchen. And Millie stays in the kitchen with Stella and Manny. "Just be kind," her dad had said. And as far as Millie can tell, Stella knows what that means. Millie watches Stella blow on her cup of tea, the steam rising up and making shapes, like the coffee did in the department store. What if everything breathed like this? Animals and people and grass and trees. Everyone and everything always, always had curling lines of steam making patterns around them. And some people would have short, quick breaths from running or heart attacks, and others would have long, slow breaths from sleeping or watching telly. It'd be like watching music, if music looked like anything, and the world would always be filled with the music of breath. Maybe when you let out your last breath, you let out everything, your memories and thoughts and things you wished you'd said and things you wished you didn't say, and the pictures in your head of hot coffee steam and the last look on your dad's face and the feeling of mud between your fingers and the wind when you run down a hill and the colour of everything, ever.
"I've never been in," Stella says. "The cemetery's just down the road. I drive past it every night, but I've never been in. Know where he is? Straight down the path as you walk in. Turn right on the first corner."
Stella sips her tea.
"Errol, my little brother."
"Errol," Millie repeats.
"Yep," Stella replies. "That's my brother. You know, I got home tonight and sat on me couch and I thought of him. I know he would have looked after you without even thinking about it. So I got back in me bloody bus, and now here we are.
Millie spoons ice cream into her mouth.
Did you see him when he was a dead thing?
She asks. Stella blows on her tea.
Yeah, she says.
What did he look like?
She pauses.
You know when someone wears glasses all the time?
Millie nods.
And then they take them off to clean them?
Yeah.
And their eyes look bigger or smaller or something?
Yep.
That's what it was like.
Were you sure it was him?
Well, I didn't do a bloody DNA test.
Do you know where he is now?
Other than in Cal Cemetery, you mean? Depends on how you think about things. Some might reckon he's up there.
Stella points up at the ceiling.
With Jimi Hendrix?
Who?
Jimi Hendrix.
The guitar bloke?
Millie shrugs.
Dad knew him.
Oh, I reckon he's just in the ground. And he's not coming back as a beetle or whatever. Or floating around watching me sit on the loo. He's just dead. Done. You're alive and then you're dead and that's it. That's the point.
Done?
Done.
Stella studies Millie.
What do you think happens?
I don't know.
There's your answer.
That's not an answer.
All I know for sure is that no one knows what's going on at the bottom of the sea, or in our brains, or when we die.
That's okay, I reckon.
Gives us something to think about, when we're driving buses or whatever.
Millie looks up at Stella, then to Manny, then back at Stella. She lowers her voice.
I think dead things turn into plastic and sometimes they get put in the shops.
Stella nods. Fair enough.
She stares at Millie, like she's an X-ray.
Where's your mum, love?
She says finally.
No funny buggers now.
Where's yours?
That sounds to me like funny buggers. She nods again. Just up the road, we don't speak.
Why not?
One of those things, I reckon.
Millie looks at her, and Stella sighs.
There's not much else to it, really. A lot of hot air.
She stands and starts placing the plates into the sink.
None of my family speak, you know. Like we can't. I'm sure you're supposed to be better than that.
Millie clears her throat.
She's gone, Mum.
Stella turns around and rests her back against the sink. Her hands drip soapy water all down her shorts.
Where, love?
One of those things, I reckon.
Stella smiles. Millie takes the piece of paper out of her pocket and unfolds it carefully. She smooths it out on the table.
It's my mum's itinerary,
she says, hoping she has the word right. Stella pulls out her glasses from her pocket and holds the paper up to the light. She folds it back and hands it to Millie. She takes off her glasses, rubs her eyes. The hum of the fridge seems loud suddenly. Stella stands at the sink and looks out the window. Her hands grip the sink so hard that her knuckles whiten.
Look, she says, not looking at Millie. Has it ever occurred to you that your mum doesn't want you to find her?
Millie holds her stomach. Stella turns and crosses her arms.
They're not your grandparents, are they?
Millie looks away.
They're helping me find mum.
Stella sits down in her chair and leans in close to Millie.
I'll take you home tomorrow, love, she says. It'll be fine, you'll see.
Millie wakes up in the middle of the night. She pulls a piece of paper out of her backpack, walks out of the bedroom and down the hallway, opens the front door, and sticks it to the door with blue tack.
In here, Mum.
She still can't sleep. So she wanders around the house, picking up ornaments, touching faces on photos, sitting on couches, trying on hats. She makes shapes in the dust on the coffee table. She opens the back door and sits on the step. The moon is big and it lights up a small, fenced-in backyard, filled with old bunches of flowers wrapped in plastic and ribbon. The clothesline rises up out of it all and squeaks around in a slow circle in the breeze. The pile is higher than Millie's head. There's plastic wrapping and coloured ribbons in pinks and greens and reds and other bright colours. But all the flowers are brown and dead. She walks down the stairs and runs both hands up and down the pile. The backs of her hands on the way up, then her palms on the way down. It's like the pictures Millie has seen of the sideways view of Earth in books. A chunk cut out of the earth. Later, she would write in her book of dead things, Number 30, Stella's Pile of Flowers. Her head detaches itself, and she's visiting her dad in the hospital. Millie had never seen so many flowers for one person. She lay on her back under his bed and watched all the visiting feet. Tiny feet, big feet, in between feet. Sneakers, high heels, sandals, red shoes, black shoes, green shoes. When all the visiting feet had left, her dad said,
I wonder where Millie is.
He was breathing hard, like old people and fat people. But he wasn't old, and he wasn't fat.
I don't know, her mum said.
Her feet crossed and recrossed as she sat in the big armchair.
Probably out robbing a bank. Or preaching for world peace.
Their words were huge and rounded, like they were winking at each other. Her dad's hand dangled down by the side of the bed. She crawled toward his hand. She had never known it so white. The machines bleeped and blurped and binged. She slipped her hand into his and held it. And now she clambers to the top of the pile of flowers, her legs sinking into the plastic and the dead flowers like it's quicksand. She thinks of the lakes made of salt and the trees made of fish, and how people can hide from their own selves and how the world is a place like nothing Millie could ever have imagined. She thinks of how Stella said that no one knows what happens at the bottom of the sea, and she wonders if sea people live quiet lives down there, watching sea television, laughing at one another's sea jokes. Would they call the sky the ocean and the ocean the sky? Would their music travel through the air in bubbles? Millie wishes that all words and music and sound travelled in bubbles. That you had to pop each one to let the sound out. How silent and surprising the world would be. You would always get a fright when someone popped a bubble and a sound jumped out of it. Ta-da! Except maybe more people would be hit by cars, and it would be harder to get your mum's attention from across the street. And what if a help bubble went sailing off into the sky, was popped by a jet plane, and no one could hear it over the roar of the engine? The clothesline spins and spins and spins overhead, creaking like an old bed. She picks up the new flowers at the top of the pile. Errol, the card reads. Millie writes, Be right back, Mum. In small letters on the bottom of the sign, and walks out of the front yard and down the street, holding Errol's bunch of flowers. When she finds the cemetery, it's lit up by the streetlights, and it's not like the one back home. It's flat, and there's no grass on the ground. Just red dirt as far as Millie can see. Large painted buckets filled with red and purple flowers. Giant gum trees lining the pathway and looming over the graves. She cranes her neck back to see the very tops of them. Her dad was always so high in the sky. She touches the bark of a tree as she walks past and thinks, Don't trees need shade too? The bark is still so hot from the daytime. The red dirt has stained the gravestones a light pink colour. The graves are separated by signs into different religions so that Millie assumes, the heavens don't get mixed up? The thought occurs to her like a kick in the stomach. Will I go to the same heaven as my dad? And then, more panicked, which heaven did he go to? She never thought to ask. There are no cars whooshing past, or planes whizzing, or birds singing. Just the leaves on the trees sliding over one another, like the sound of someone wiping their feet on a welcome mat. It is the most perfect sound, a sound that is barely a sound at all. A just enough sound, so that she knows she is still here. And then she sees it. First right, on the corner. She kneels beside the grave, carefully placing the flowers in front of it. The red stones make imprints on her knees. Millie licks her fingers and rubs the red dirt out from the indentations on the gravestone. Errol, Millie says. His name is sunken on there, like it's breathing him in. The start date and the end date are always the important bits on the gravestones, written in big letters. The dash in between is always so small you can barely see it. Surely the dash should be big and bright and amazing. Or not, depending on how you had lived. Surely the dash should show how this dead thing had lived. Did Errol ever know that his life would be just a dash on a gravestone? That everything he did and all the food he ate and the car trips he took and the kisses he gave would all end up as a line on a rock. In a park with a whole lot of strangers. Millie lies down flat on her back, the top of her head touching the base of the gravestone. She spreads her body out as far as it will go, reaching her arms out wide, stretching out her fingers so that they're as far away from one another as possible. She looks up at the night sky through the break in the trees and can only think of one word, so she says it out loud. Dad? And suddenly she's certain she's the smallest thing that's ever been made, smaller than even the bits of gravel in her back or the ants that crawl around her feet, because the world is so big, full of trees and stars and dying, and she thinks maybe a dash is most exactly what she is. Another fact Millie knows for sure. When her dad was in the hospital, the words, "Dad, are you becoming a dead thing?" wouldn't come out.
Agatha Panther. 9:06 p.m. Sits in a foreign chair, in a foreign room, in a foreign house, drinking tea out of a foreign cup, at a foreign time slot, and tries not to think about it. "What's wrong with your hands?" Agatha yells at the typist. The typist puts his tea down on the coffee table and hides his hands under his armpits. "Nothing," he says. "Why do they twitch like that?" she says. "They're not twitching," he says. "They look like they're twitching," she says. "They're not twitching," he repeats. "They're typing." "Typing?" she says. "Typing," he confirms. "Why are they doing that?" she says. He shrugs. "You don't want to tell me?" she says. "Not really," he says. 9:11. "This tea is terrible," she whispers loudly to him. 9:13. "What's that?" he says. Her age book sticks out of the top of her handbag. "Your diary?" She pushes it back inside her handbag and zips it up. "What's what?" she says. "The thing you just put in your handbag," he says. "I didn't put anything in my handbag," she says. "Yes, you did," he says. "No, I didn't," she says. 9:16. "Your wife?" Agatha says. "Passed," he says. "Ron, too," she says. "Heart attack outside the pet shop." "You?" He sits on his hands. "Cancer," he says. Agatha nods. 9:17. "Why did you bother me at my house?" she says. "Maybe you're in love with me," she adds.
I'm not in love with you, the typist says. That's what someone who was in love with me would say, Agatha says. I don't even know you, he says. No, she says, you don't. 9:18. But what she wanted to say was, why did you stop coming to my house? 9:20. The typist falls asleep, his head leaning back on the couch, his mouth wide open, snoring. 9:22. They shall not grow old, she whispers, as we who are left grow old. 9:23. Agatha Panther allows herself to feel lonely.
Carl, the touch typist. Sometime between night and morning, Carl makes his way down the hallway to use the toilet, but stops when he overhears Stella talking in the kitchen.
Yeah, she's saying. An abandoned child, yeah.
Carl leans his back into the wall next to the kitchen doorway. The light from the kitchen stretches out across the hallway like the entrance to another, better world.
Don't know a whole lot, she continues. Her mum's skipped town. Her dad's no longer with us. Some old folks are helping her out. She pauses. Yeah, look, I don't know. The woman's completely burko. The bike's not much better. They're just old, I guess.
Carl presses his fingers together.
Great, she says. Yeah, I'll bring them in tomorrow. And Bert, she hesitates. Sorry to be ringing so early, just couldn't sleep with the thought of it all.
She pauses again.
You're a good enough sort, Bert. Ta-da.
Carl's guts churn. He hears the sound of the phone being placed back in its cradle. The light clicks off and the other better world disappears. Carl flattens himself against the wall, sucks in a breath and shuts his eyes as hard as he can, with the logic of a child.
If I can't see you, you can't see me.
When Carl opens his eyes, he can just make out Stella at the end of the hallway, turning into her bedroom. He walks into the kitchen and stares at the phone. Stella's keys are on the kitchen table, lying there, cool, metallic, like an exotic insect. He sneaks into Agatha's room.
Agatha?
He whispers as loudly as he dares, trying to shake her gently awake. Her snores are relentless.
Agatha?
He says again, a little louder.
What is it?
She says, sitting up, pulling the blanket up under her chin.
Who are you? What do you want from me?
She gropes at her bedside table for her glasses.
Shh, Carl says, handing the glasses to her. Please, Agatha.
She puts on the glasses and stares at him.
Typist! You're not getting in here with me. I'll give you that news. It's 4:46. This is when I sleep.
Carl sits on the edge of her bed. He feels the warmth under his legs.
We need to go, Agatha. We need to go now.
But when they turn on the light in Millie's room, she's gone. Carl slings Manny under his arm, and Agatha grabs Millie's backpack, and they leave Stella's house as quietly as the floorboards allow them. Manny's leg sticks out the top of Millie's backpack, the plastic toes bouncing up and down behind Agatha's head. Carl leans Manny up against Stella's bus and puts a hand on Manny's shoulder.
Keep watch, Manny, he says gravely. He's plastic, typist, Agatha hisses and slides the backpack next to Manny.
Together, Carl and Agatha make their way down the street, calling for Millie, looking under cars, in front yards and up trees. They walk past the cemetery and hear voices. On the other side of the cemetery, with the help of some intermittent streetlights, Carl sees three men stumbling their way drunkenly toward them. The men laugh and swear. One of them attempts to climb a tree. Another pees straight up into the air. The third throws a bottle against a gravestone. It smashes, and the noise carries in the still night. Dogs in neighboring houses start to bark.
Oh, no, Carl says.
What?
Agatha says. Carl points.
Oh, no, Agatha says.
And there's Millie, not far from the drunken men, seated on the ground with her back against a gravestone.
They're headed straight for her, Carl says, leaning through the black iron bars of the gate.
I can't go in there, Agatha says quickly. I don't...
She stops.
All those dead people, she says quietly. They can't make me.
The drunks spot Millie.
Hey,
they say, and then...
What are you doing out here in the dark? You're just a kid, aren't you?
Millie stands. Carl's stomach lurches. Another bottle crashes loudly, and Millie tries to walk away from them, but they surround her. And then...
You reckon you're Dora the Explorer or some shit?
Agatha puts her hand in Carl's. And it does something. Sends an electric current up his arm. His brain kick-starts as if it's been in a long slumber. Sleeping Beauty, or whatever the man version of that is. There's got to be one, but he can't think straight. He's too busy thinking about her hand, sticky with sweat and rough. His hand feels soft in hers.
What are you doing out here all by yourself, Dora?
Agatha squeezes Carl's hand. Carl looks at her in his peripheral vision, that electric current. He turns to her.
We're taking the bus, he whispers. What do you mean? We're taking it, Agatha whispers back. I mean, he says, handing her Stella's keys. Start the bus. We're stealing it.
And he thinks he sees Agatha's smile. Or maybe it's a twitch, he's not sure.
I don't,
she starts to say, but Carl's already running, although it's more like a shuffle. The drunks wave their beers in the air at Millie.
Want some of me jungle juice, Dora?
One of them says, and Millie looks petrified. Carl doesn't know what he's going to do when he gets there. He thinks, Evie, she would know what to do. But he just has to get there because Millie's just a child. She's just a child.
Hey!
He says as he approaches them, but they don't hear him. So he yells it,
Hey!
They all turn, and Millie runs to him and hugs him around the legs. He puts a hand on her head and stands in front of her, shielding her from the men.
Hey!
He says again, quieter, steadying himself on his feet. They could all be the same person, these three men. Blue jeans, work boots, hair spiked up at such odd angles that it surely can't be deliberate. As if they've hairsprayed it in a wind tunnel. Their eyes follow Carl with a vagueness, like Carl is invisible and they're looking in the general direction of his voice. One wears a blue trucker's hat with a surf label on it, another has a t-shirt with breast police scrawled across it, the third wears a long-sleeved flannelette shirt.
It's Dora's grandpa,
Blue Hat says, and pushes Carl, and Carl says, I don't want any trouble, and breast police says,
haven't you heard, you old fuck? This is the Cow Cemetery creche.
Carl starts backing away, holding his hands up in the air like he's seen people do in the movies, and Blue Hat says,
we're just giving Dora her milk, then we're gonna put her to bed,
and pushes Carl again, and Carl stumbles, and Carl says,
do what you like to me, just... Don't hurt the little girl. She's just a child. Just let her go.
They're red-eyed and swaying and surrounding them from every angle. They stink of alcohol and they don't care. Carl can see that clearly. They don't care about themselves or their lives, and this makes them dangerous. And Carl says,
Go, Millie, go.
But she doesn't. She puts her hand in his and buries her face into his leg, and he closes his eyes and thinks,
Well, this is it.
But then a voice... Too drunk, Agatha appears behind the men and swings Manny's leg around as a weapon. She hits Flannelette square on the back of the head and he falls to the ground, hitting a gravestone on the way down. He is knocked clean out. She swings the leg wildly at the other two.
Hey, Blue Hat says. Whoa, lady,
breast police slurs.
We're just...
He looks like he's made of jelly as he falls into a tree trunk and hugs it, pushing his face into the bark.
Having some fun.
Yeah, Agatha says. Yeah, doesn't look like fun to me.
She swings at Blue Hat and misses. Blue Hat puts his hands behind his head and twirls his crotch around and around in a circle.
You want some of this? He says. You just gotta ask, sweet cheeks.
Agatha walks toward him and kicks him as hard as she can in the shins.
Ah-hey!
He says, grabbing at his leg, hopping a few steps and then falling in the dust.
Trousers too tight!
She swings Manny's leg at breast police and just misses a kneecap.
Not enough teeth!
Another swing that almost hits an elbow.
Bleak futures! You crazy lady!
Blue Hat says.
Agatha stands over him and kicks him again, in the bum this time. "Stop doing that," he says, and stretches for her ankle, but misses and face-plants onto the ground. Agatha stands on both of his hands. "I," she says as he tries to wriggle free, "am not." He lifts his head and tries to spit at her. "Crazy," she kicks dirt in his face. "Come on, mate," Blue Hat slurs, crawling away from Agatha and trying to stand. "This is bullshit." "Yeah," Breast Police agrees. "This is bullshit."
"I'll be writing to your mothers," Agatha says.
"What did you say about me, Ma?" Blue Hat says.
"Mate, come on," Breast Police says.
Nah, Blue Hat says, "look, lady, we're gonna go get Nanners and Scob and Fleety and we're gonna come back and we're gonna finish this."
He points an unsteady finger at Agatha and then vomits on his shirt.
"Shit,"
he says.
"Shit." "Don't worry, mate,"
Breast Police says.
"But this isn't my shirt, man."
"Don't worry, it'll come right out." They sling their arms around each other's shoulders like old lovers and hobble off toward the exit, traversing the cemetery from side to side as if it's a ski hill, singing half sentences from a football-themed song as they do so. "Up, up to win the Premiership flag." Millie wraps her arms around Agatha's waist. Agatha pats her awkwardly on the head. Carl wants to hug Agatha too, to rest his chin on her head and say, "thank you," to put a hand on Millie's head and say, "you're okay," but he doesn't. What would Branson Spike do? Instead, he says,
"You two get to the bus. You'll be safe there."
He feels strong and in charge all of a sudden.
"I'll cover our tracks."
He nods in the direction of Flannelette. Agatha looks at him skeptically.
"Well, don't plonk about for too long. You heard them. Flutie and Nunchuck and Scabber on their way."
"One minute," Carl says. As Agatha and Millie wander out of the cemetery, Carl pulls out the marker he stole from the nursing home. He kneels down next to the gravestone, rolls up Flannelette's sleeve and writes on his forearm, "Carl the Touch Typist was here." He pulls back, looks at his handiwork and grins hugely. The sweat on Flannelette's forearm makes the ink run, and the words look like the title of a horror movie. Carl glances toward the road. It's starting to get light. They need to get going. He reaches into Flannelette's pockets and pulls out a wallet. Opens it up. He feels a buzz in his body, like this is the Carl he's been working toward his entire life. He thinks, "I am Carl the Touch Typist. Present tense." The sun is coming up. Carl feels invincible. He has made decisions, protected women, granted with some help from said women, defaced public property, stolen money, resisted arrest. He can't stop smiling as he fusses over Manny in the front seat of the bus, buckling him in. Millie sits next to Manny, nursing his unattached leg.
"You did a good job guarding the bus, Manny," Carl says, patting him on the head.
"Yes," Millie says, pushing into Manny's side and leaning her head on him. "Good job, Manny." "Yes, yes, yes," Agatha says. She sits in the driver's seat and riffles through her handbag. "The plastic man did a very good job."
"Are we stealing this bus?" Millie says.
"We're getting you to your mum, Millie," Carl says.
"Are we going on the train?"
"Yes, Millie."
"I don't have any money."
Carl feels the wad of cash pulsing in his pocket. "Just leave that part up to me." Millie looks out the window at Stella's house.
"So we're stealing this bus?"
"Borrowing it."
"Like you borrowed those computer keys?"
"Yes, exactly."
"So we're stealing it?"
"Yes."
"But it's Stella's bus."
"Yes, it's not ours."
"Stella's brother died."
"I didn't know that."
"I don't think we should steal the bus."
"Sometimes grown-ups know best," Carl says.
"Sometimes grown-ups don't know anything," Millie says.
But before they can discuss just who does know best, Blue Hat appears in their headlights. "Hey!" he says, banging on the front window. "Close the door, Agatha," Carl says quietly.
"I don't..." "Hey!" Blue Hat says again, kicking the tire. "Told you we'd be back!"
Carl stands and sees Breast Police on one side of the bus and another man he doesn't recognize on the other side. Breast Police has a cricket bat and grins menacingly at Carl through the glass. The men slap the sides of the bus with the palms of their hands. "Close the door, Agatha," Carl says again, louder this time. "How do you..." "Hey!" Blue Hat stands at the bottom of the steps to the bus, in the doorway, brandishing a broken bottle, his eyes fierce, his nostrils flared. "Close the door, Agatha!" Carl shouts as Blue Hat puts his foot on the bottom step at the same time as Agatha finds the button and slams it down with her hand. Blue Hat is half in and half out of the bus, and he squeezes one arm through the gap while using his shoulder to push against the closing door. He waves the broken bottle around, almost slashing Carl's hand, as Carl tries to shove him out of the bus. "Stay back, Millie," Carl says. Millie finds objects to throw at the man, a first aid kit, and some specs, and a T-shirt, and an apple core, and Blue Hat fends them off with his bottle like an amateur fencer. Carl tries to kick at him without getting too close. A window smashes at the back of the bus. Carl says, "Drive! Just drive, Agatha!" "I haven't driven for 7 years. Work it out!" "Okay, I don't... Do I? Is this... You can do it, Agatha!" Millie says. The bus chokes and splutters and finally starts. "I did it! I did it!" Agatha says. "Now what do I do?" "Drive!" "Oh, yes!" And the bus starts moving, slowly, jerkily. And Blue Hat hops along next to them with one foot inside the bus and one hand clutching the edge of the door. Carl unbuckles Manny, holds him up high above his head, says, "This won't hurt a bit, Manny," but he's lying, and goes to throw Manny in the direction of Blue Hat. Manny will save them again, Carl knows, knock the bottle out of Blue Hat's hand, dislodge his foot, crush his fingertips. "Say goodbye, Blue Hat," Carl says. But just as he does, time seems to slow. The thumps on the side of the bus become like distant drum beats on a faraway island. And it is in this moment that Carl realizes that this man is just a drunk and angry boy. He's not a man at all. Pimples line his face and his eyes are filled with the kind of anger that doesn't know any other way. He is angry for a reason, and the reason is not Carl. Carl recognizes the struggle to be a man and wants to say, "It's okay, I'm on your side." And for a moment he thinks he might be able to negotiate with this drunk man, this drunk boy. So he begins to lower Manny. But then there's a flash and the drunk man boy has lunged and cut a gash in Carl's palm. "Carl," Millie says from behind him. "What?" Agatha says, and the bus swerves to miss a gutter. "It's okay," Carl says, though he doesn't know yet if it is okay, and he feels weak at the knees at the thought of the blood gushing from his palm, so he doesn't look. He is not going to try to understand the drunk man boy any more. "You know, drunk man boy," he thinks, "I've a lot to be angry about too." And he summons all of his anger into his arms and feels like Superman or the Incredible Hulk or that 16-year-old boy from this morning and holds Manny triumphantly over his head and throws him as hard as he can at the door. But the bus rolls over a speed bump at the same time and Carl loses his footing. Manny is thrown straight up into the air. Carl falls backward onto his behind and Manny topples next to him. The bus is still moving slowly, but Blue Hat has to hop fast to keep up. Millie pushes on Blue Hat's foot with her foot and bites his shin, and Blue Hat swears and takes a swipe at her, and Carl says, "Get away from him, Millie!" And Agatha mounts the gutter and says, "Oh!" When she almost hits a tree on the verge, Agatha finds the road again, and Blue Hat falls and his foot comes loose. Carl and Millie run to the side windows to watch him roll along the road behind them. "Everybody okay?" Carl says. "Just Millie?" "I think so," Millie says, climbing onto the seat behind Agatha. Carl picks up Manny from the floor and inspects him for injuries. "Agatha?" "Oh, I'm fine," Agatha says. "Just fine. Just suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but other than that..." "Is he gone?" The bus trundles down the street, passing small and dark brick houses. There are children in school uniforms. A man in a dressing gown picking up a paper, a lady walking her dog. "He's gone," Carl says. He sits in the seat opposite Millie, holding Manny on his lap. "Good," Agatha says.